So sign this thing. Okay. Record. Okay. Today is Monday, August 27th, 2018. A big hello to the students in front of me and to all those listening around the world. The question of Kashrut, which we're discussing in America, unfortunately is very timely and haunts us right now. A Talmud who listens in South Africa for many years already, I hope I'm pronouncing your last name right, it's W-A-K-S that I'll pronounce Wax, Bram Wax. If I'm wrong, please correct me. First of all, you asked me if I read the book, Oh My Son by Chaim Shapiro. I absolutely read the book, and anyone who hasn't read it, it's a must reading. It's published by Feldheim. It's about the late Rabbi Chaim Shapiro of Baltimore running away in World War II. His brother is killed before his eyes. He runs away from Hitler, goes into the deep part of Russia. And Bram says, from that book, I've learned about communist Russia. And I want to tell communist Russia, and that part of the Russian Empire was mild compared to the big cities where it was much more westernized and the pressure was much greater. Regarding Kashrut, and I knew about this, but here I have all the details. A tremendous scandal just broke in South Africa. And one of the biggest of the local caterers, believe it or not, in South Africa in the year 2018, they found treif chickens in the kitchen. A whole shipment of treif chickens. It's Stan and Pete's lost their kashrut license. And the rabbinate in South Africa is shaking. And it comes back to what we said many, many weeks ago, months ago already, that you can have all the hashgacha in the world, but if the people are not reliable, they can always fake you out. That's the realistic situation. There's no hashgacha you can give 24/7. There's no one in the world. I'm going to hire Rabbi Reuben to give hashgacha in the kitchen. There's no way he can be there 24/7. You have to have confidence. And these people, unbelievable. And the hashgacha in South Africa is one of a kind. There's no machlokes there. It's just the Beit Din of South Africa. Everyone is united. I was in South Africa. I saw the inner of South Africa. I spoke and saw from the chief rabbi down to many of the rabbanim. Terrific people. And a tremendous amount of Balei Tshuva. It could be that the South African Jews hit more than 50% Shomrei Shabbos. Lo mechallelim Shabbat b'Pesach. I don't know if there's any other place in the world, maybe Montreal. Montreal also has a very, very high percentage of Shmirat Shabbat. It's the Sfadim there, Chabad there, there's a Litvashi Yeshiva there. Whatever the reasons are, we know a lot of Montreal Jews moved down to Toronto, but nevertheless, Montreal, what they picked up from France, certainly increased the Shmirat Shabbat. And with all that, when it comes to money. Now, what's interesting in South Africa is that with all the finesse of the rabbinate, the mashgichim were still being paid by the store owners. And that's a terrible situation. That's going on right now in Israel. It's before the Beit, the Mishpat, the Bagats, as they call it. Those of you who know, you're living here, you know what's going on. The same question is coming up right now, haunting us in the state of Israel. Here it is in South Africa. In South Africa, what's interesting is the Beit Din called in three great experts to help them reorganize and how they can avoid ever having a problem like this again. They call in, it's exactly number one, Rabbi Menachem Ganak. I don't have to tell you who he is. The Rakefet calls him the Tsar of Kashrut. Rabbi Moshe Elefant, who is the Chief Operating Executive Rabbinic Coordinator of OU Kashrut. He has a fabulous reputation. I think he also gives a Daf Yomi on the OU website that people tell me it's one of the finest Daf Yomis in the world. There are many Daf Yomis that you can pick up on website. This Rabbi Elefant is very special. And the third person is Rabbi Shalom Fishbein, who is from the Chicago Rabbinical Council, the CRC, which also is a very good hechsher. So you see what we're studying about. With all these problems, here it is, money, the human being. And for me personally, it's very depressing because I come from a different world. I don't know, it hurts. I saw Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. I saw the Talmidim of Rabbi Yisrael. I saw the Altas Talmidim. I saw Mayom Mashkiach, Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Cohen Lesson. I saw the Shanghai survivors. I've told you more than once that now a book came out on the Rav. And you should see, it's a collection of articles and pilpil and pilpil and more pilpil, the Rav and the philosophic influences on him. And why does he quote this and doesn't quote that? And the Catholic Church and what influence their theologians had and the Protestants. A book just came out now, edited by two fabulous people, Professor Schwartz of Bar-Ilan and Rabbi Conor Fogel of Bernard Revel. And I read it and I don't know, I'm laughing. This is the Rav, this is all right, this was a sideshow. But I have to tell you, there is a footnote that agrees with Rakefer. I've always said that the Rav used the philosophy in a homiletical sense to put Yiddishkeit into contemporary terminology. And there is one footnote that suddenly wakes up and says it could be that we can't create a system for the Rav because it was homiletics, it was used basically for Dvar Hashem, Zu Halacha, but he had to give it a framework that people could appreciate in the 20th century. But be it as it may, it hurts that even in the year 2018, in South Africa, to imagine in Muncie, to 20 years ago, whatever it was, 15 years ago, in Muncie, a religious Jew, so-called, the man who opposed the Arab, I don't want to mention his name, I know his name, and in the middle of the night to take treif chickens and wrap them with kosher wrappings. And there's no way you can have hashgacha. There is no way you can have hashgacha. A human being is a human being. I mean, I try my best. My life is davening in Torah. I was already learning at 4 o'clock this morning. You know, I don't have to tell my friend. You know me. But by Islam, you have children, you have grandchildren, you have great-grandchildren. You can't. It's impossible. It hurts. And all right, Reb Lezer Suva, they did the best they could. But the man, the OU, deserves all the credit in the world. And what the OU did, it revolutionized kashrut around the world. So much so that South Africa, who did they turn to if not the OU right now? And if the Chief Rabbi had any sense, I would call in the OU. The question is, does the OU have enough manpower? And tell them, tell us how to run kashrut in Israel. Lead us, guide us, set the standards. The OU could lead the way. All right, now I just want to end off. The credit goes more than anyone, and even Reb Lezer Suva, you know, that can of treif beans, I have to tell you, I laugh. I grew up hearing that when I was a kid, that they've caught a can of Heinz with an OU with pork and beans in the can. And until today, I don't know whether it really happened, didn't happen. You see what I said last week. You heard it from William Weiss, the head of the OU. He seems, and even if it did happen, but look at the million other cans. So, all right, Reb Lezer made his peace. They made their peace because of Rabbi Rosenberg. Now, Rabbi Alexander Rosenberg, his years 1903 to 1972. I'm quoting from two sources. The New York Times obituary when he died in 72. And then Jewish Action had a beautiful article calling him the guru of kashrut, Rabbi Alexander Rosenberg and the transformation of kosher certification in America. And this individual, he is the one. I met him, I knew him on by the way, the Jewish Action is fall of 2013. I didn't know him intimately. I was a kid when I met him. I had just come in Aliyah. But he was friendly with someone also, is much older than I am, but he befriended me, someone named Reuven Gross, Ruby Gross. Maybe you recognize the name. There's a book that came out, The Pledge. Are you familiar with The Pledge? Anyone read The Pledge? The Pledge was a bestseller. It was about Jews from outside of Israel who came to Israel and gave their lives in order that we should win the war in 48. Ruby Gross was one of them. I think I told you many years ago, he said to me, and I said to me, Aaron, you should know, I killed my wife. I looked at him, and he told me the story. I cried with him. What happened was, she was expecting their first child, and he left her to come to Israel. He was the radio operator for the Haganah. Read the pledge. There's a whole chapter on him. And she gave birth, and her husband wasn't there, post-mortem, I think it's called, syndrome. And she went into a depression, and she died. And he remarried later. He had many, many other children, a beautiful family. But he always said to me, look at the price, look at the devotion, look what we paid to establish this magnificent state. So that's Ruby Gross. And he knew Rabbi Rosenberg. And as Charlie said, Rabbi Rosenberg was a mechutin with Rabbi Schwab. Okay, did you know him too? How do you tie in your family? Postpartum. P-A-R. T-U-M. Okay, thank you. Thank you for correcting me. And this was Rabbi Rosenberg. Now, Rabbi Rosenberg's background, you look at his picture, right away you get the feeling that he was influenced by German Orthodoxy. That way a Yekesha Rav lived. You understand? These Chiddush Rabbanim had a different, they already never touched their beards. And the Litvish Rabbanim, you're lucky if they had beards in those days. But he was Hungarian. He came to America. He already was he came to America in 21, so he was already more than a teenager, a young adult. He studied at Yeshiva Shabbos Chol Hanan, and he was rabbi in Yonkers. I still remember, I don't believe that shul exists anymore, but he was then, Yonkers was a fancy neighborhood, Jews moving out of the Bronx. It's before Riverdale. But he was rabbi in Yonkers. Then came World War II. After World War II, they needed Rabbanim to go to Europe, to go to the DP camps. A lot of great people were Meisa Nefesh to help in the DP camps. Rabbi Rosenberg was one of them. Why was he so successful? Because obviously he spoke German, he spoke Hungarian. He could go in and he could deal with the authorities. He spoke English, he spoke Yiddish, and he could deal with the DP camps. And right after World War II ended with the DP camps, he was one of those instrumental in setting up kosher kishkes. Well, when you get involved in Germany, in Poland, kosher kitchens, he got involved in kashrut. And when he came back to the United States, he was appointed to head up the OU, and he put it on the map. From 1950 to 1972, he was Mr. Kashrus. And he's the one who introduced the concept that the firm that is supervised does not pay the mashgiach. The mashgiach is paid by the OU. The OU has a fee that you have to pay to get their supervision. Obviously, it depends. A milchika place, a parava place, a fleishika place, obviously would cost much more to supervise. But all the money went through the OU. In addition, he put a rule in, and if you read the papers in Israel, it's laughable. He put a rule in, not only can't the mashgiach take a salary from those who employ him, but he's not allowed to accept any gifts. And this going on in Israel, you read the testimony, people are mashgichim, they come in once a week, they look what's going on, and they take out food for their whole family for Shabbos. You follow? In addition to whatever salary they're being paid. And he put in ironclad rules. All right, they give you statistics here. When he took over, the OU had a total of 40 mashgichim certifying 184 products. When he passed on and was finished with the OU, 750 mashgichim to certify more than 2,500 products in 475 companies. Right after him, Beryl Wine took over, and then in 1980, a young man, Rabbi Menachem Ginnack, a fine Talmud Chacham, Yerei Shemayim, from a very wonderful family that has very close connections, the Genachovsky family. Ginnack is really Genachovsky. His family had very close connections with the Rav. His uncle was a Talmud Mufak of Reb Moshe Soloveitchik in Warsaw. When the Rav went to Berlin, Reb Moshe made his peace with it, because Menachem's uncle went with the Rav to Berlin and kept an eye on him. He was a little bit older. Yes, Morty.
You know, you deal with this business, since it's not a 24-hour mashgiach, you have to trust the person. How do they deal with it?
Well, first of all, when you're dealing with non-Jews, there's no problem whatsoever. There's absolute trust. And this is what the Trudy Rosemarian attacked Reb Lasa Silva, that the Goyim were washing off the meat in Pittsburgh, and the Rav said, I heard this with my own ears, as ich halt, as min kemesh samach sein af a Goy upgessen the flesh, the Ayid. You tell him what to do, and he has Kherdat HaKodesh. How do you deal, what's the, with the OU, in other words, they check everything coming in. Where do you buy? How much comes in? How much do you sell? There's evidently down to a science that it's a check and balance system. But the fact that the OU doesn't let you pay the mashgichim, and that they have a supervisor coming in and checking how the supervisor on the spot works, and then there's a general supervisor, evidently the system works. But to answer your question, there is no answer. Ultimately, with every hashgacha in the world, you can have a problem. And these were the, I told you, with the OU, there are three problems I know of. Two in the actual hashgacha, and one with the money. And both problems were with Jews. The kosher dress poultry in Chicago, how can you supervise the middle of the night? And 2 o'clock in the morning, he's taking a Caribbean kid or a Cuban kid who works there. Help me schlep, I'll give you $20. No, the kid, $20 is big money. The kid at that time, the kid schlepped, and conscience bothered him. He went to the priest. This is the story I was told. And the priest told him, go to the rabbi. The rabbi couldn't believe his ears. It was Erev Yom Kippur. And they set up scouts to check. And sure enough, 2 o'clock in the morning. So really, there is no ultimately with kashrut. You want to be certain. You have to do everything yourself. You have to slaughter the chickens. You have to kasher them. Your wife has to kasher them. You have to do everything yourself. And then if you leak peanuts, you got to hope that it's in vegetable oil, not in lard. Ultimately. But as far as the biggest organization in the world with the most safeguards, that's the OU. All right, that's Rabbi Alexander Rosenberg today.
What was the second company that they had trouble with?
The second company was Richards. I told you about it, with the executive vice, the vice president in charge of purchase. And instead of purchasing the caseinate, what's it called? Sodium caseinate? Am I correct? I think that's what it's called. But anyway, the casein, instead of being from animals, part of is twice the price. So he was buying, it's unbelievable. A Jewish guy was buying the tafrid, didn't believe it was the kosher, pocketing the difference in money. And he was arrested. He was going to face trial. I told you, his daughter got married. And under the chuppah, he had a heart attack and died. If you ever saw divine justice, that was it. The other story was money, was a mashgiach who was taking money. Somehow he got his hand on the till. And that, Rabbi Dov Zakheim, remember he said he was the controller for the OU, he caught it. And I know that story, I know what happened afterwards, but the guy, let me rest in peace. It was a Yira Talmud Chacham, it was a Yira Peyesha, and he needed money. It was a very sad story. The OU said either you pay back or we're reporting you to the police. So he sold this house, and he paid back every penny. But it's a terrible story, but this is human frailty. I always had a problem of understanding the Ten Commandments. Could you imagine people just saw Maimed HaSinai? Masherata Shifchal Hayam, Lo Ra'ayi Cheskel Bembuzi, because you're not Shalom. And you got to tell them, lo tiknov, lo tietzach, lo tinov, lo tana bereicha et sheka. You got to tell them that? Yes, you got to tell them that. Just now, in a yeshiva, one student knifed another. You don't know what's going on in Israel. He's badly injured in a yeshiva. One student knifed another. God have mercy. What humans are capable of. You heard the news this morning. There was a shooting in Jacksonville, Florida. Killed, shot, random. Who's the killer? David Katz. Could you imagine? That's the name, David Katz. Yeah, listen to the news. I hope maybe they'll find out. His father is Jewish, that's asked the name Katz, and his mother is not. Maybe we can still say, but he's not Jewish. But who knows? It's all over the world. It's the big news. The president already sent condolences, President Trump, and he contacted the governor of Florida, and he, whatever help you need, etc. All right. Let us go a step further, and now we're coming into another very, very major area. And the truth of the matter is that the whole history of American Torah could have been different if is the biggest, the most important, the most challenging, the most tantalizing word in the dictionary. If. And here, of course, you're coming to Agudas HaRabbanim vis-a-vis the young rabbis. Essentially, everything I'm commenting on appears in the Silver Era, Chapter 4. And I would say, of all my research, this is among the most important documents that I uncovered. Of course, what I'm telling you orally is a lot more than the written word. There's a limit to what you can write. Whenever you write, it's a Torah Shebichtav. You need a Torah Shebal Peh to deal with the Torah Shebichtav. Now, just try to put yourself back in the 1920s. The Rabbanim are in America already 30 years, good 30 years, 1890, 1900, 1910, 1920. Now, if you come to Israel and you're here 30 years, the chances are that Simon came not being able to speak Hebrew. But 30 years later, you're speaking Hebrew, you're integrated, you worked, you had to work, you had to learn. I'm totally at home in Hebrew. All right, I'm here 50 years, Kanain Hara, but I was totally at home many decades ago. I served in the army, I worked in the Mossad. Yeah, I taught in Michlala, I taught, I was a kid, I was just here. I started teaching Michlala, I was here in my third year, I started teaching in Michlala, the Israeli division. I finished with the encyclopedia. So, all right, every Thursday I used to sit with some very elegant young ladies, Rav Goldwich's daughter, Rav Kahana's daughter. There was a third girl out in Tel Aviv whose father headed up a bank, and they would help me with my Hebrew. There were words, I can tell you until today, words they taught me. For instance, crutches. What's the Hebrew word for crutches? Kabayim. Did you ever use that word in B'nai Akiva? We were young, healthy kids. But they taught me the word kabayim. Rav Goni. Multifaceted. I have written down the words they taught me back in 1971. Yeah, that, of course, you have to integrate. Charlie, if you're a Rav, what did a Rav do in Europe? Et gezitz den egelernt, he learned shas and paiskim, paskim, shilas, dealt with the questions I dealt with yesterday and dealt with a week ago and I'll be dealing with next week. What did a Rav do in America? He sat and learned. He did nothing else. How did he manage? The Rebbetzin took care of everything. Did you ever see a Yudapayish Rav? Let's go back to 1920 and you'll see the Rav was humble. His wife led him by the hand. She did the shopping. She dealt with the people. She managed a little bit English. She was way ahead of her husband. She dealt with the children. She dealt with the school. The Rebbetzins, when you saw an Agudas HaRabbanim convention, they sat men and women together. The man's joy, his pride, to use Tanakhic language, his Nevat Beito, the jewel of his house, was his wife. She Americanized. He didn't. So now, by 1920, you have the rabbi who's still basically European, but he's dealing now with a second generation, with a third generation. These kids are total Americans. It's like today I have great-grandchildren coming over this afternoon. All right, we have pizza for them, we have ice cream for them. But when you will hear their Hebrew, these kids are geniuses. 2 years old, 3 years old, 4 years old. They're rattling off. They're totally integrated. I'm lucky they don't laugh at their grandfather and their grandmother. I, Baruch Hashem, they have their inheritance. They're taught, you know, by their parents, by their grandparents, that your great-grandparents deserve to be complimented. They came in Aliyah, they brought us here, etc. But in America, you have this chasm. Now, listen to this. The name Harris Zelek mean anything to you? Gentlemen, Blumenthal, what do you think? Harris Zelek. Make believe you the name so the ignorant pass for the wise. Do you know my work on Bernard Reveler by heart, yes or no? If you don't know that work, you can't understand why you got to know it by heart, Harris Zelek, but we'll leave that for another time with why you. This summer, I was crying from last March, and I'm still in tears, some of the things I saw. Harris Zelek, was he right? Harris Zelek was a son of a Rav, a Yudapeish Rav. He learned in Volozhin, and he came to America, and he Americanized. He was a bit of a businessman. Rabbi Revel hired him to head up public relations for the yeshiva in the 1920s as they started the campaign to raise X millions of dollars to build what they wanted to build, the campus. And going through Rabbi Revel's papers, I found a manuscript. Couldn't find it anywhere else. But evidently it's a talk that Harris Zelek had smicha too. But he was known as Harris Zelek, had good American name. Maybe his name was Heschelay, but Harris, interesting name. Listen to him. This is his talk. Speak English. Is it not the curse of almost all American synagogues and congregations? A rabbi, may he be even so great a scholar, possessing a knowledge of Talmud and the codes to an unusual degree. What is his standing alongside of the English-speaking rabbi? While the rabbi was able to speak a fluent English, may be ever so empty and ignorant, yet he is recognized as a leader, as an authority on things Jewish. Rabbis Isaac Elchanan, Yosef Ben Soloveitchik, Chaim Soloveitchik, Joseph Zecharia Stern, Meir Simcha, and others of the great celebrated European scholars and leaders who are the pride of and object of worship to our fathers were no speakers. The great rabbis of the Jewish communities in our old home spoke but seldom from the pulpit. They usually preached only on Shabbos Agadol and occasionally also on Shabbos Tshuva. The public did, however, respect the scholarship and the great Jewish knowledge embodied in their person. This respect that we paid the scholarship has been lost after our arrival in America. The statue of a rabbi is not measured any longer by his knowledge, but by his speech-making ability. Let him be but a good speaker, no matter how ignorant he may be. He has no difficulty in becoming the leader of his community and its ruler. My late father, of blessed memory, who in his day had been the rabbi of several leading Russian communities, said to me once that he felt certain Moshe Rabbeinu would never have obtained a rabbinical position in America because he stammered a bit And an American rabbi must, above everything, be a good speaker. And then he goes on to describe the American rabbinate.
Who's the audience he's talking to?
It's a manuscript. So you don't know if he ever... It's a manuscript that, as far as I know, was never published.
Is it possible that it's not more than a manuscript? Maybe it's the text of a talk he gave to our Reed's graduates.
Yeah, it's possible. But we have no way of knowing. We can only come up with theories, but the contents hits the nail on the head.
It makes sense then.
He captures the era. He says, in Europe, a rabbi employed his leisure hours in study and becoming a gaon and answering questions and writing tshuvot. And here in America, he employs his leisure hours not in study, but in calling upon his members and their wives and to organize brotherhoods and sisterhoods in order that they too may meet and indulge in speech making. I have to tell you, that's a very, very good comment. In other words, he's cynical, but he hits the nail on the head. And you see, what you have here, who fits the bill? These rabbis, the conservative movement. The 1920s is basically the time when the conservative movement goes from first base to third base. It's the 1940s, 1950s that they score home runs one after another. But this was the situation. This is where you stood. This is what was happening. And you have the Elter Rabbanim, the Europeish Rabbanim, they're lost. Their influence is diminished. The grandparents can still relate to them. The parents can still relate to them to a certain degree. The grandchildren, basically not at all. And this was the situation that Reb Lazer Silver inherits as he becomes the president of the Agudas HaRabbanim and the leading rabbinical figure on the Torah American scene. Now, Rabbi Silver did something, and here I had a lot of mazel. How do I come to the Silver archives, the Revel archives? I was living in America, we're talking 62, 63, 64, perhaps 65. The Silver archives, I'm here in Israel. But when Rav David Leib Silver, his son, met me at the Kotel, it has to be in 71, perhaps 72. So when I did my work on Rabbi Revel, I got to know the Silver family because Rav David Leib Silver was the Talmud Mufak of Rabbi Revel. So we got to know each other. And then he approached me, would you like to do a work on my father? So I told him, I think I've told you the story, I told him, look, I have a doctorate, I don't need another doctorate. Go and Bernard Revel Graduate School, see that they should assign the doctorate. So he went to Bernard Revel Graduate School, and the truth was, no one was interested. This is a hard doctorate, you have to create something yesh meyayin. It's not like doing a doctorate, editing a manuscript. A manuscript, all right, it's not that hard. The manuscript is in front of you. If you have proper scholarly technique, you can edit it. So no one was interested. So a year later, he came back to me, and I said, okay, how do I get to the archives? So he said, I'll photograph them and transfer it to you, which is what he did. So I have it. The archives are a half minute from here in my office. And I had all these photographs, Xerox copies of what Xeroxing was at that time. It's not as on the level of today, but it still was quite good, of all these documents in Rabbi Silver's archives. Now, he did a survey of the rabbinate, both the Agudas HaRabbanim rabbinate, and he got lists of all the young rabbis coming out of, there were two main institutions then, Yeshivas Reb Yitzchok Hanan, which nowadays the young Arbisfeld will refer to as Yeshiva University, but technically it was Yeshivas Reb Yitzchok Hanan, and the graduates of the Hebrew Theological College in Chicago. The Hebrew Theological College, which many histories have been written about it, but it's yet to have a definitive volume, there was a Rabbi Saul Silber in Chicago, and he saw how Rietz is succeeding in turning out rabbis who can meet the needs, or at least attempt to meet the needs, of the new American generation. So he said Chicago needs an institution like that, and he organized the Hebrew Theological College. The story of the Hebrew Theological College could have been so different, because as you all know, they brought Mori Urebi, Rabbi Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik to America. Imagine had they kept their word and hired him, and the Rav would have come in 1932 to Chicago. I think Chicago would be a major, major Torah center, and New York today would just be Brooklyn. But all of Washington Heights and Riverdale and all that goes with it on the Upper West Side would be in Chicago. But what happened was the Depression, and they said to Reb Moshe, that famous program, we've kept our word, we brought your son, but we can't hire him as we promised. We have no money. 1932, Depression, find the shtela for him on the East Coast, and that's how the Rev winds up in Boston, and as they say, the rest is history. Now, you have the graduates, Hebrew Theological College, you have Rietz. Rabbi Silva had entree to these institutions, YU, what we call today YU. His son was a student. His son-in-law is going to be from that school. The Chicago is not that far from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. It's not the other end of the world. He knew what was going on. And forget about Harrisburg. By now he's afterwards in Springfield and then in Cincinnati, so he knows America. And he actually sent survey questions, very modern technique. I don't know, maybe Reb David Lev advised him. Very modern technique. Surveys go on all the time. When you looked, if you went online this morning, you found the survey, who is the most admired minister in the government of Israel? Ayelet Shaked, she went out number one. Late dropped down to number five. The last time they did the survey, he was number one. He's now number nine. And you have the analysis. Leitzman is happy because the less the Chilonim like him, the more the Hasidim like him. You follow it in diverse proportion. So surveys every other day. What's going to be if there was an election? Don't you get calls on the phone? They drive you crazy with these stupid surveys. All right. Reb Lazer Silva was ahead of his time. And you can read, I'm not going to, the Elder Rabbanim, the questions, are you satisfied? What can we do for you? How can we improve? How can the Agudat Yisrael help you? And I'll tell you what's amazing. When you look at the answers, you see the frustration of the rabbinate. Endless machloket. Why can't we have peace? Why do Rabbanim have to fight with each other? Why do we eat each other up alive? And one Rav promotes the idea that every morning all the rabbis should learn Chovat HaLevavot. If they study Chovat HaLevavot, they'll be nicer to each other. And I have to tell you, it's not a bad idea. Today, you could talk a half through the internet. Everyone could be learning Chovat Levavot and interacting. We've just come to pass. Ribbono Shel Olam, what we have on the internet. But we're now talking the late 1920s. And the Balabatim who caused us such aggravation. And here, I quote when Rabbi Arav stated, the sons of Korach have not died. Obviously, it was in Hebrew. B'nei Korach, it's the Medrash. Odom metu. They are rather found in every town and hamlet. They curse and swear at the rabbis. while the Agudas Rabbanim stands at a distance. And you got to remember, they wanted an ovation. We'll see soon what the rabbis were facing, what they were undergoing. But I have to tell you, I have to digress and tell you a true story. This Bididi Havi Uvda, 1977, when we came in Aliyah, 69, July. Did you check? Is it 4th, 5th? I mean, the government says we came July 5th, but it's probably because we reached the Jewish agency after midnight, because the boat docked after Shabbos. It stayed out of... Today, Haaretz would scream, Hadatah, forcing people to be religious. But okay, in those days, they had other problems. I didn't scream about that. So... I never thought I would see the America again. You have to understand, we came, we were kids, we were poor, we had no money, etc., etc. We had never lived in Israel before. There was an aliyah, kula l'shem shamayim. So in 1977, the government sent me back for the first time to speak at the RCA convention. By then I was a full-fledged Israeli. I already was in the army, did basic, etc. So I come back, and my parents were then, we were packing up, we brought them an aliyah later that year. So my parents lived in Pelham Parkway. From the time I got married, they moved out of the Bronx, because the East Bronx became an impossible place to live. They lived in Pelham Parkway. So we davened, my father's Shabbos, during the week he davened in his shtibbel. But Shabbos he davened in Rabbi Shalom Reuben Shul. You've heard the name, remember the name, Rabbi Shalom Reuben. He was married at the time to Mr. Urim Bunim's daughter, Chana. You know Chana, Bunim, Reuben, Pupko, Osabel. That's who he was married to. I taught three of their four children. And he was a famous rabbi. And I'll never forget, he gets up to speak Shabbos, and the Balabatim sitting right in front of him, most of them survivors, their native language, Yiddish, and he's getting up to speak, young Israel of Pelham Parkway, and the Balabatim is sitting there and maledicting him that he could hear. And he gets up and his speech begins, B'nei Karach lo mesu, the kinder from Karach of Nishkishtolten, they didn't die. They're sitting right here and looking at me. And I couldn't believe my ears. I mean, I was in the rabbinate. Goy, if you spoke like that, the Balabatim would kick you out the next night. What are you going to talk like that, the Balabatim? And here, this is a rabbinic aphorism. Here the rabbis, B'nei Korach lo metu, and the Agudas HaRabbanim does nothing to help us. All right. That was the original questionnaire to the Agudas HaRabbanim. And it reflects, it tells you what the period was like, and it haunts us. There's really no solution. You're a rabbi isolated in your own community. The Balabatim want innovations. The kids want English. You can't speak English. You're limited. The Elter Rabbanim, the Elter Balabatim, the older Balabatim are happy with you. You're caught in a quagmire. This survey was done with the Agudas Rabbanim in 1927. In 1930, he turns to the Reitz and the Hebrew Theological College, what we call Skokie today. He turns to their graduates. And here he sends a beautiful questionnaire. It's a photograph. When you get the answers, it's literally a photograph of what was going on in the American rabbinate at that moment in time. And he writes a beautiful introduction. He wants the young rabbis to know, as the president of the Agudas HaRabbanim, I am desirous of learning about the spiritual and temporal status of every Orthodox rabbi. The translations into English are my own. The original document is in Hebrew. I am particularly interested in the graduates of the American yeshivat. All our hopes rest upon them, and we constantly pray that they will follow in our path. This is the way the great rabbis of all generations have conducted themselves. They completely dedicated themselves to Torah study and educated their followers in the authentic Torah traditions. And you see, he's absolutely right here. I've often said this more than once as someone who studied both with great Rabbanim, great Rosh Yeshiva, and professors. In a yeshiva, I never yet had a Rebbe who was jealous of his students. The greatest joy a Rebbe can have is that his students should be smarter than him, greater than him, more learned than him, more Yirat Shemayim. The greatest joy that a student can have, that a Rebbe can have. This is, the Gemara says, Einav mekane bivno, v'ein rav mekane b'talmido. When you go to professors, Rebbeinu Shel Olam, could there be jealousy? Could there be beneath the surface? And what my student's going to come along and critique me, and his scholarship is going to reach different conclusions. And I remember when I got my doctorate, I've told this story many times. I don't recall who. Someone asked me, do I recall who on the faculty of Menorah? This professor or professor said to me, all right, you got your doctorate, Rothkopf. Now you'll never do any scholarship again like the rest of the rabbis who get their doctorate. And that's all I had to hear. Within 1 year, I won a prize for the best postdoctoral research on a Torah, on a Jewish American topic, my work on the Ritbaz. When I actually won a prize. You can look into JPS, the yearbooks. You'll see it's cited as one of the best, if not the best, postdoctoral research that year on someone who didn't succeed in America. Everyone thinks you came to America and you succeeded and lifted dollar bills off the tree. With the Ritbaz, it didn't happen. So Reb Lazer Silver's right that if we don't have great Rabbanim to take over tomorrow, the Jewish people have no future. None of us are going to live forever. And preparing the leadership of tomorrow is the greatest challenge and the greatest achievement, the greatest satisfaction that we can see our students, our children, taking the torch further. So, Reb Lazer, beautiful introduction, but the questions, where were you ordained? When were you ordained? How many years have you been in the act of rabbinate? Do you daily study in Shas and Poskim? Think back now to Harris Zelig's talk, letter, whatever, manuscript. Yitzchak, I have to call it a manuscript because there's no indication where he published it, if he published it, where he spoke about it. You have to call it a manuscript. It could be you're right that he addressed what's called Yeshiva Rabbinic Alumni at the time. Today it's called YURA, Yeshiva University Rabbinic Alumni. Is there a Chevra Shas in your community? Are you the teacher? Do you occasionally discuss Torah topics with an elder Rav? If you do not, would you desire the Agudat HaRabbanim to designate a Rav to be your mentor? Do you follow that question? Here, you're a Rav, and you come to the Boston area. It's a congregation. They had a big fight. They don't want an elder Rav. Some want a conservative rabbi. So they settled on an English-speaking Reitz graduate. No, how much can he learn? Wiffle can I learn? Simon, you're learning Yiddish? How's it working out? If I don't translate, just raise your hand. I'm supposed to translate from Yiddish to Goyisha language. I got a letter about your father that someone picked up. It's down in Sherry's office now because I want to answer. Beautiful letter about your father. You have plenty to be proud of. They heard your name on the shir. Beautiful letter. Atlanta is an amazing community. So you're here, you're in a community. There's an Elter Rav a half hour away. Would you like to meet with him once a week? Would you like him as a mentor? And there's a lot to be said for this. When my first shtela in Pennsylvania, in Lower Marion, I used to go and speak and learning with Rav Yalas, Rav Ephraim Yalas. He was the photographic memory, bucking in Shas, backwards and forwards, Every Tosfot, you have no idea. Did he accomplish much in Philadelphia? No, nothing whatsoever. The conservatives ruled the city. But that's not, it was beyond his control. There was Rabbi Novosela, there was Rabbi Frankel, Rabbi Putgold, the Malaysian Rav. These were all Hasheva Rabbanim, but the time was against them. But I remember when I had to sell chametz the first time, when I had to, you know, be the shliach for the tzibor, I went to him, how do you do a shtar? And by the way, it was hard for me to follow him because he got involved with pupilim, with sources. And, you know, today I would follow him a lot better than I was a kid. How much did I know? At the age of 23, you leave the yeshiva, you're an amaretz gamur. Smicha, Simon says, we hereby certify that Simon Italiana is an amaretz. But now we feel he's ready to start learning. So we're ending our bechinis and we're ending, forcing him to learn what we want him to do. And now we hope he will learn all of Shas and Paiskim and conquer the world. That's what Smicha is all about. So I remember I went to Rabbi Yalis. He was very nice to me, I have to tell you. The fact that later his daughter marries Rabbi Goldblum, already was married to Rabbi Goldblum, there was a connection, but I didn't even know of that connection. He was very nice. Yeah, no, he was...
I felt very funny because I was a young guy.
Right.
And he was a girl, and he was a poacher.
Right.
Yeah, I felt closer to talk to him than the Rav.
That's, he wasn't as frightening as the Rav. The Rav, you always felt there was a certain distance. It's not like Rabbaran Soloveitchik. Rabbaran, you felt you were talking to your chaver. You understand? Rabbaran was a gon adir. Rabbaran Soloveitchik, I'm talking about. But there wasn't that feeling that you had with the Rav, there was a certain jickness, I would say, that came with Gatlet. You follow? And Rabbaran did not have it, the Rav had it, so I understand exactly what you're saying. In later years, unfortunately, the Rav mellowed, and I couldn't believe in the 70s, the 80s, the Talmidim. Wow, it was a different ballpark altogether. We were lucky that we studied with the Rav when we were afraid to approach him, because it meant we had to try harder. We had to climb the ladder. Okay, don't get me started with the Rav. I can tell you endless stories to support what I just said. All right, do you write Chiddushin Torah and pupilistic novella? Of course. If you're studying, you have to be Machadesh. Had you studied the laws of Mikvot, Shulchan Aruch Eben Ezra, the laws of Gittin? Good question. How many tractates of the Talmud have you studied? And do you consult the response of literature? You see, Jack, they want to know if you go to Aaron Rakefet's classes here. Is there a Hebrew school in your community under your supervision? How many teachers? How many students? Is the Gemara studied? And remember, if a Hebrew school doesn't teach a kid Gemara, you've taught him nothing. All you've taught him is how to say Kaddish. And, you know, that's the old story with the Talmud Torah, where the kid comes in, he's 8 years old, and he comes home, and he's learned the alphabet now, and when he's 9 years old, Yizgadal, the Yizkadash, and the father's hysterical, he runs to the principal, how dare you teach my son how to say Kaddish? Don't worry, Mr. Big Shot, by the time your son learns how to say Kaddish, you'll be more than 120 years old. But you see, if you don't teach a kid Gemara, you cut him off. He can't go further. Gemara is the key to knowing what Yiddishkeit is about. Without Gemara, we're Christians. We just believe in the Old Testament, the written Torah. But the whole oral Torah is beyond our grasp. One of the few places in all of America where kids went to Talmud Torah and they came out of it knowing a Dafara was Boston. The Rav in his Talmud Torah, Mishkan Yisrael, I believe it was called, they had a high school program where kids came in the afternoon from high school and they learned Gemara. The Gordon brothers, Jimmy and Macy Gordon, that's where they learned Gemara, in that high school. But that's what this question is. Do you teach Gemara? No, how many Talmud Torahs taught Gemara? There was some on the east side in Brooklyn that were exceptional, and a certain percentage of those kids, Taka, remained from. But the question is here, do you have a mikveh in your community? How has it been constructed? Who administers Gittin in your community? Do you supervise Kashrut? And are the Sheikhtim under your guidance? Does your synagogue have a balcony for the women? Or are they separated from the men only by a partition? Or do the men and women sit together? God forbid. And you see, in Europe, all the shuls basically had balconies. Certainly among the Ashkenazic tradition. Among the Sfardim, there were many shuls where women simply didn't come to daven at all. Women weren't expected to go to shul. But among the Ashkenazim, there were always balconies. This story I told you with Max Setra, with the Kehilat Jeshurun, with Rabbi Joseph H. Luchstein. The story is an amazing story, but it's absolutely true. I heard it from the people involved, that in post-World War II, on the Upper East Side, you had to use a microscope to find a frumjo. So Kehilat Jeshurun, Shabbos morning, this beautiful shul built in the early 1900s, magnificent shul, 40 people. That was the whole crowd at the Shabbos morning service. Hard to believe today. Today, Kehilat Jeshurun, 5 services, hundreds upon hundreds and hundreds of Shomrei Shabbos. People who are billionaires, Shomrei Shabbos. People who were related to the President of the United States, Shomrei Shabbos, Kehilat Jeshurun. So, little Rabbi Joseph Luchstein, we used to call him behind his back Little Joe. He was our homiletics teacher, a mouth of gold. When he opened his mouth, pearls poured out of his mouth. Yeah, little guy, how tall was he? It's got 5'1", would you say? Not much taller, maybe 5'2". So Rabbi Luchstein came up with the idea, bring the women downstairs, put up a machitza, and men and women, maybe it'll attract more. The women don't have to walk up. And the board of trustees voted, Rabbi, that's what you want. Fine, good, beautiful. And the next morning at Minyan, the president of the shul, the biggest donor, Max Etra, what's your first name?
Harvey.
Make believe you heard the name. You'll ask your grandfather. He'll tell you. Mr. Etra, Max Etra says, Rabbi, you can do what you want, but I'll have to leave the shul. And Rabbi Luchstein starts shaking. Why? What's wrong? Well, I went home and I told my mother your plan, and my mother said, that shul you cannot daven in if it doesn't have a balcony. And that's how Kehilat Jeshurun not only has a balcony, but when a fire destroyed the shul a few years ago and they rebuilt it now, I understand you got to walk up not 2 flights, but 3 flights to get to the women's section. There's a Shabbos elevator for those who need it. But they have a balcony and they have thousands of people on a Shabbos morning today. But that's the question. These are the loaded questions. Do you conduct late Friday night services? Now you see, you're going to go into the rabbinate, Simon. No one is going to bother you with late Friday night services. Because today, wherever you go, there are Jews who are shomer Torah and mitzvot. And in every Orthodox shul, there's a basis in the New York area, in the Chicago area. And you have shuls where there isn't one family that's Mechallel Shabbos. You have hundreds, thousands from families. But even where you have a nucleus only of from families, everyone knows there's no such thing like a late Friday night service. And during the winter months, you have an Onik Shabbos. You bring in a dummy from Israel. You have a speaker. Oh, a Friday night, a speaker. And everyone comes. And afterwards, you have food. And food attracts. It's unbelievable. You might think people are poor today. They eat in their house. They eat in the shul. To be an Orthodox Jew, you need 2 stomachs. There's no question about it. 2 stomachs. Late Friday night services, you have no idea what a problem this was, because everyone worked on Friday. It's not like today. If you're a Shomer Shabbos in New York and other states, state law declares they have to let you out early. people respect religion today. It's a different ballpark. People don't observe it all. People don't believe in God in the Western world. But those who do, we respect. You do your thing, we do our thing. Don't interfere with us. We will not interfere with you. In those days, no one got out early. Friday night, you worked 5.5 days. I remember growing up, 5.5 days. Shabbos afternoon, I told you, I had a neighbor, Mr. Weinstein, Zichrono Livracha. He knew Gemara, he learned in Europe. When he came home Friday, Shabbos afternoon, I used to go over to his house, came home from work, Shabbos afternoon, I'd go over, and whatever help I needed in Gemara, he was able to help me. He was amazing, a man who knew every Gemara. I couldn't believe it. All right, thank God. I've achieved that much in life, that you can open up a Gemara and it can help you. But that was everyone worked. Ah, so Friday night, they want to go to shul. Shabbos begins 4:30. Shabbos begins 5 o'clock. They want to go to shul. They can't go to shul until 8 o'clock. So the temples, Reform, Conservative, they had late Friday night services. Well, if they have, why can't we have in a so-called Orthodox synagogue? And this problem haunted us. You should know that it continues until today. Those of you who have been in Australia, have been in South Africa, I was in Australia in a very shul, a beautiful shul, built into a mountain. The women walked in, they were right there, and the men had to walk upstairs to where the main shul was. It was perfect for the women, and it was the men who had to do the walking. And Friday night, it was unbelievable. If Mincha began at 4:30, you had Mincha. After Mincha, the rabbi taught a class. After the rabbi taught a class, they began Kabbalat Shabbos and dragged it out. Then the guest rabbi from Israel spoke. By the time they reached Baruchu, 2 hours later, the place was filled. You should know there was a breakaway from that shul. They went down the block, bought a house, and they said to me, "Where's Shlomo Shabbos? We want to read at 5 o'clock. We want to read at 5:30. We have to wait until 7:30 because those people have to get home from work." And that's a vestige of the late Friday night service. But this was a real problem. Do social dancing or card games take place in your synagogue? If you don't start to understand what this question is all about. Right here in this building, there's a very famous rabbi. I'm not going to mention his name. We go back to time immemorial. His mother and father met at a dance at the youngest of the Bronx. So you're wondering, social dancing in a synagogue? You all heard of the name Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein. He was the Rabbi Riskin of his times. He used to march through Harlem with us on Sunday morning with all the kids marching behind him with flags, waving flags, going to Sunday school to be proud to be Jews. This is Harlem, the 1910s, the 1920s, Herbert S. Goldstein. And in his shul, talking West Side Institutional Synagogue, there were dances once a week. His grandson, Rabbi Rochelle, who wrote the biography about his grandfather, has a very hard time. He's a wonderful person, Rabbi Aaron Rochelle, but he had a very hard time trying to explain, justify. But you have to understand, these people felt, these rabbis felt, that for boys and girls to meet, all right, Eit Lasot Lashem Heferu Torah Techa. It's better to have a dance in the shul they should meet and get married than, God forbid, the intermarriage already beginning in the United States in the 1920s, the 1930s. So that's the question about the dancing. Today, no one can understand this dancing in the shul. Whoever heard of it? We have different shilas today. When the shul runs the dinner, can the men and women sit together? Or you all sit separate? And this is a different shilas altogether. I'm not happy about separate seating at a dinner. That's a different story. If I go out, I want to sit next to my wife. I have an obligation to sit next to her. That's all I can say. But okay, the world moves beyond Rakefet. I'm in Zayin Gesund. If I saw good results, I'd say good. I don't see any better results. Adarabba, the Adarabba. We have to have a more normative attitude towards sex. Kadesh Atzmacha, B'muta Lachan, the full sense of the word. And I've given many lectures on it that are on yutorah.org. But coming back here, cards, a card playing. Ay, how much blood was shed over this. Bingo in the shoes. Remember, you have a budget to raise. People love to gamble. All right, Mesachek Bekuvya. Mesachek Bekuvya, Pussel the Eidit. But what does it mean, Mesachek Bekuvya? If Simon decides that his whole living is going to be Mesachek Bekuvya, and this is how he's going to make a buck, and he's going to learn how to deal the cards and under the table and all that goes with it, he's Taka Pussel the Eidit. But if Simon says, Rebbe, once a week I want to relax, and we bet a few, those days, you bet a quarter, right? Today, I see in America, a dollar has no value. A dollar is like a 10-cent piece when I'm growing up. So you bet a few dollars, so at the worst, I'll lose $10 a week, but I have 2 hours of enjoyment of gambling. Maybe I'll win. It's not possible, Yates, I'm sorry. Look into the Rishonim, look into the postgame, you'll see. So, cards, bingo, this was a problem, this problem. Does it still haunt us until today? I don't know. But I remember in my youth, how many times this Rebbe was asked, this Rebbe was asked. And the answer was, they didn't give an answer. They looked the other way. They knew the shul's how to support themselves. It's not in the shul proper. It's downstairs. Mesachek Bekuvya. Goyim come in and play too. What's wrong with taking some money from Gentiles to help the shul flourish? Oh boy, does this capture the era? Does an elder rav occasionally preach in your synagogue? And you see, this went on all over the United States. And the classic example is Rabbi Yehuda Leib Foyer. Harvey, Rabbi Yehuda Leib Foyer. I mentioned the name to you the other day. I forget when we met in that temple of human achievement, we'll call it. Did you see the dress I told you about? The collar's dress? The dress. You go to on the left. We met in the museum on Friday. And you see, Rabbi Yehuda Leib Foyer was the greatest gaon ever to set foot in America. So in Holyoke, they broke away from the Orthodox shul and they organized a shtickle temple. They refused to hire a rabbi. Yes, for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they used to bring in a seminary graduate to preach or a seminary student, but they said to Rabbi Foyer, as long as you're alive, you're our rabbi. So you see, once in a while, he would preach, he would speak in Yiddish. They related to him. See, you're caught between two worlds. Reform didn't grab these kids yet. That has to happen a third or fourth generation. But conservatism was the best of both worlds. The melting pot, you're an American. You worship the way an American understands it to be proper and upright and decent and contemporary. And at the same time, ethnic feeling. You're still Jewish yet. There's some Hebrew in the service. Amola Rav Kuntarain. Once in a while a rabbi comes in and a Eret Yiddish and he speaks in Yiddish. And that was the question. Is there still a connection? What is your relationship with conservative reform spiritual leaders? Do you jointly officiate at marriages with them? Oh boy, this question is loaded. Your relationship, this is the question that haunts us. What's your first name?
Judah.
Yehuda, Baruch Hashem. Yehuda, you're here, right?
I live here permanently.
Kol HaKavod. Yehuda Blumenthal.
Yehuda Aaron
Blumenthal. Beautiful. Aaron is my name. Beautiful, beautiful. Yehuda, beautiful. Yitzchak, we have to be proud. You see what the world turns out? Lo Alman Yisrael, a new generation. He's sitting here. You know what's going to be in 50 years? His descendants, you'll fill a shul when they celebrate his 80th birthday. You follow me? You look at one, but you don't realize what happens down the line. I saw it my birthday. I was overwhelmed. I couldn't believe what I saw. Can I know? Same thing with the Balei Tshuva, with Russia. Here. One second. See this picture? Okay. Just think how many descendants there are today. Just think. This is in Odessa, which was the hardest city.
The KGB
ruled by in hand because you were nowhere near an American consul. Follow? That's Yitz's wife, Judy Zichrona Levracha, and that's a mother and daughter that both their husbands were in prison. Both their husbands were in prison. And could you imagine what it took? This is where David Applebaum was arrested. He tried to go see them, and he was arrested. And they wanted to throw him into jail yet. You have no idea what went on. He refused to go in. So they questioned him, put him under house arrest. He called the American embassy in Leningrad or Moscow. He finally got through. I write about it in my new book. You'll see it all. But what a beautiful...
KGB warned me not to go back in that neighborhood.
Hooliganim. That's the Russian word. I got the same warning in Minsk. Hooliganim. We can't be responsible to hooliganim on the street.
The same day, I had gone to the Beryaski store.
Right.
I spent $700. I bought two radios. I never forgot. Both were short-wave radios. One was Panasonic, both sharp. The guy wouldn't sell them. He said, "What are you buying in here? We can give you cheap in America." I said, "Oh no, I can't. For some reason, your price is much better." Anyway, I said, "Judy, we got to bring these radios to the publisher. I didn't buy it to take to America."
Right,
so
of course.
Went that night. I said, "You hold the radios. I was a real coward. They're not going to beat up a woman. So you call the radios." So we went. Now they lived on that radios for 6 months.
Right.
Because they sold it in the black market.
Right. That was the, I write in the new book, what my wife did with the camera we brought in our middle trip. She kicked it along. The KGB never saw it. They were too busy looking through our suitcases. What? That was on the floor. That camera supported the study in Moscow. All the photographs they make was they couldn't Xerox. It was all controlled by the government. But photography that you developed, no one could control.
They did that with the book Exodus.
Right. So exactly. For 1 year, they sold the camera on the black market. Oh, God. We can be proud of what we did. Baruch Hashem. On Yom HaTzmut, when you say Hallel, one of the reasons is for Nativ, that part of the Mossad. But anyway, coming back here, the question of relationship with Reform and Conservative, that absolutely haunts us. Haunts us until today. And here you see it, this later with Synagogue Council becomes the big explosion. What do you do today? The conservative rabbi in Haifa who was arrested, what went on, performed a wedding against the laws of Israel. Who are you? What are you? Who gives authority? He was arrested. Our friend Isaac Herzog, Yitzchak Halevi Herzog, the new head of the Jewish agency, you should have read the weekend. What do you think of the Reform Jews? His grandfather would have been Korea to hear someone talk like that. And this question haunts us. Do you officiate at joint weddings with them? This is the crucial question. When they come to a wedding, a family wedding, I've been asked this question 1,000 times over. Halacha l'maisa, I answer, look, it all depends on circumstances, but you can't do more than let them have a bracha. In other words, the actual siddur kedushin and the edim, that you cannot honor a conservative or reform rabbi. They're puzzled to aid us, plain and simple. If the family insists it's their rabbi, the kid is a Baal Tshuva, you don't offend the parents, so I tell them, fine, let them have one of the brachot. I don't know, you can tell me what others paskin, but that's what I paskin under the circumstances. I base myself upon the story with the Rav, which I know to be absolutely true. I told you the story many times where this kid came, was in the MTA, Talmudical Academy, I don't know how many of you went there, but in my time, it was the greatest school in the world. Everything I, ungesapt, I don't know how to say that in English, everything I absorbed Yiddishkeit in my veins, my bones, comes from Talmudical Academy. Those were very formative, wonderful years, wonderful rebbeim. So this kid was in Talmudical Academy years later, and he goes to the dean, the principal, George Finkelstein, Rabbi Finkelstein. And he says to Rabbi Finkelstein, look, I've become totally frum and CSY, this. My father's a reform rabbi. I'm going home for Pesach. What do I do? I have no place to daven. What do I do? How do I handle my father? My home is kosher. That's not a problem, he says. So Rabbi Finkelstein says, I'm going to make an appointment for you with the Rav. And he makes an appointment. They go to the Rav's dormitory room where I've stayed this past March, and the dormitory apartment, and they sit down on the couch. The couch is still there. And the Rav says to him, I quote word by word, as told to me many times by Rabbi Finkelstein. He told it to me in Bishas Meiser and years later. And the Rav said to him, you will give your father all the respect that he deserves. He pays for you. He sent you to yeshiva. He said, what you'll do, you'll daven at home, and then you'll go with your father to the temple. You can take a sefer with you, a tehillim with you, and you'll say what you wish. You'll read what you want. But when everyone sits, you'll stand. When everyone sits, you sit. So, all right, if the family insists, you don't offend, a bracha. So that's this question. It's a very, very difficult question. Are you a member of any rabbinic group? And we will see next time we meet Be'ezrat Hashem that there were two other rabbinic groups at this moment in time. Nature abhors a vacuum. And Harvey, if you're going to have an Agudas HaRabbanim, and the Agudas HaRabbanim is going to say, we don't want you American schnipniks, what do you know, who are you, how many years have you studied, Wiffel, Shansen, Peiskin, Kempman, they don't want you. So you're going to form your own group. One group was the Yeshiva Rabbinic Alumni. They would meet regularly. There was camaraderie. There was a good feeling there. The other group was a shoot-off from the OU, because the OU needed rabbis. They needed rabbis to supervise the kashrut. So the OU it remains until today a lay organization, but a group of rabbis started being formed around the OU. Later, they will combine and form the Rabbinical Council of America. But that's the question. Are you a member of any rabbinic group? What is your attitude towards the Agudas HaRabbanim? Lenny, what kind of question is this? A very important question. You see, today, people have an attitude. Some people, I'll give you an example. Herbie Maltz comes to the Sunday class, and today's in Kollel. So a Talmud, evidently someone who sat here for many years, because I didn't get I'm pretty sure I identified who it was. So this Talmud just got married, and he has Hasidic inclinations. I imagine more Breslau than Chabad, but it's a combination. And he moved in, he just rented an apartment in Herbie's building on Rehov Palmach, a Rehov that's not unknown to many of us sitting in this room. And Herbie met the guy Friday. Herbie sits next to me Friday night at the early davening in the Shtiblach, the plugged minion, and he's hysterical. How do you have a student like that with an unkempt beard, with big prayers behind his ears? And you see, they're Jews. I am who I am. I'm not ashamed. I'm not proud. This is me. It's the way I was raised. I studied with the Rav. I studied. What do you want out of me? I look now the way I looked when I sat at Rebbe's feet. All right, you'd have matured. I should say that. We'll leave that for a different lifetime. So Herbie was so upset. No, what's your attitude? You see a Jew in black right away, a draft dodger. That Jew wearing a bekesha can pull out of his pocket that he's an officer in the Israeli army. You understand? Not everyone is a draft dodger. And what if the guy's learning Torah day and night? All right, I understand. If I had my choice, everyone has to do army. It's a key of the oraita. It's a mitzvah. It's a Muhammad mitzvah. But all right, you got to be a little bit broad-minded. Rakefet has his point of view. The Gerich Chassidim have their point of view. Panovich has their point of view. Mekas Rav has their point. We should all live for Shalom. Shalom uveshalva. We observe Shabbat, we observe Kashrut, we observe Tarat Mishpacha. That's what a Jew is about. Everything else is very, very, very secondary. So that's what they want. People had the attitude, Oy vey, Hagudas HaRabbanim, black, Europeisha, backward, ignoramuses, boors, they don't know mathematics. No, where did you see this in the history of yeshiva? Yitzchak, 1941, January, at the end of that month, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik dies. Who is the little candidate to succeed Reb Moshe? His eldest son, Moreinu v'Rabbeinu, Reb Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. Do you know how much opposition there was to the Rav? Did you know Yehuda? Did you see the commentator? You know what happened to that commentator? They took all the issues and threw it into the Harlem River. One guy has one copy, and I'm not going to mention his name because he happens to live at Rav Chaim Berlin 18. Try to figure out who we're talking about. He came in Aliyah July 5th, 1969. You should see that commentator, what they say about the Rav. Black, Agunas HaRabbanim, friend of Reb Lazer Silva, phony, money under the table, every crime you can think of. So you see, this is a very good question. What's your attitude to the Agunas HaRabbanim? You should know the person who wrote the, I don't want to say it in public.
I know.
You know who I'm talking about. He told me, he said to me, Aaron, you should know, it was the greatest mistake of my life. I'm quoting him, the greatest mistake. Did the Rav ever forgive me? I'm not certain. It really hurt the Rav. And the Soloveitchiks, you know, the Rav went crazy when a kid mentioned the Ritbaz in class. You know what I'm talking about. And they came to me. Why was the Rav so upset? I told them, they think I'm a genius. I did research on the Ritbaz. I should know how to answer the question. They never forgave the Ritbaz for what he said about Reb Chaim. Read the introduction to the Ritbaz Sefer. Reb Chaim, a chemist, the chemiker, calls him a chemist, the chimia. A chemist, that he takes apart the Gemara like you take apart hydrogen and oxygen. And he laughed at Reb Chaim. Oh, they never forgave him. I don't know. But what an attitude. I think my Weltanschauung is much healthier. My only problem is I'm the only one who talks like this. Everyone else go my way and everyone else on the highway. Throw them out. It's a terrible, there's so much enmity today. It's beyond words. The elections, I said of what, whenever we have elections in Israel, it brings out the worst in the Torah Jew. Look at Jerusalem. Look at Beit Shemesh. Ugh, you go every community, they're fighting the Agudat Yisrael, Degel HaTorah. The Agudah and Degel HaTorah hate each other more than their enmity towards Haaretz and merits and all. Uri Avneri. I think Uri Avneri is a bigger hero for them than Lo Aleinu, the other side that they don't believe in. Forget it. Let's come back here. Don't get me upset. The next question haunts me. You'll understand why when my new book comes out and I try to explain the hidden secrets in Rakafat Aram Chelik Dalet. And Harvey, there are hidden secrets. This is not a simple text. So here I'm sitting in Rav Shmuel Lazenvolk's class. Atelja, the man was a giant of Torah. What Hitler did to him, had Europe remained Europe, I told you he would have been Telzer Rosh Yeshiva, threw him into Baltimore, then to New York, the Bronx. Everyone laughed at him. So one time he asked the class, here's a man who shas and paiskim and kudshim and tara. Ugh. He asked the class, he said, I understand, fashtay, everything was in Yiddish. I understand that you fellas are busy with high school, college. All right, I learned a lot more when I was your age. But is there anyone in this room who wants to master all of Shas? later, when you have time, like I said to Simon, when you get your Merz degree, start learning on your own. You follow me? Two hands went up. My hand and Melvin Zalewski, who later becomes a rabbi and a medical doctor. And we're the only two hands that went up in that class. And Baruch Hashem, I would recall everything I learned, but Baruch Hashem, don't want to say an extra word. Question 21. Do you wish to become truly proficient in Torah knowledge like the well-known Rabbanim? That's a wonderful question. All right, we understand you're Americans. We understand you how to go to elementary school. We understand you how to go to high school. We understand you how to go to college. But what is the ultimate goal? Do you want to get there and become truly learned? Where are your values? That's what that question really is. And 22, do you intend to remain in the active rabbinate? And here you have to understand, this was a period and we lived to see a sea change. Rabbis generally are not stupid. To study to be a rabbi, you got to have a good head. You got to have a good mind. You got to pass all these exams, major, master all this knowledge. No, guy goes into the rabbinate and he sees the pitfalls, the balabatim, the b'nei korach. Goes back to school. And you should know, one of the most prominent rabbis of the era we're talking about became a psychiatrist. No, Raphael Gold, the brother of Zev Gold, Rabbi Dr. Raphael Gold, was the younger brother to the world-famous Rabbi Zev Gold, for whom Machon Gold is named, the great speaker, the great Mizrahi leader. Oh, who would dream that a day would come that there are endless doctors today who became rabbis? The greatest example is right in Young Israel, Hillcrest. Dr. Weiss, graduates Einstein, never spent one day practicing medicine. Evidently, he did it. His parents pleaded with him. Our son, the doctor, gets the MD. He's been in the rabbinate ever since. Talmud Chacham, Yerushalayim. It's a different world today. But this question, done. Do you intend to remain in the active rabbinate? My dear students, I wouldn't miss the next class for all the gold in Fort Knox. What were the answers? What did we learn from this? How did they deal with Rabbi Suva's questions? So today is a very basic class. You're caught up. It's like a movie couldn't do it better than these questionnaires. You're caught up in transition. You're caught up in the earlier generation. Elech Yidden, Mitelech Rabbanim, Alts is in Yiddish, everything is in Yiddish. It's the old country that came to America. And here you are, a generation or two later. The rabbis are still in Europe, basically. Their wives are not. But the rabbis are, more or less. And then you have a new rabbinate. The conservative is breathing down our backs. Rabbi Revel reads Chicago, Rabbi Silva, Silba, S-I-L-B-E-R. And here's Rabbi Lazar Silva trying to accommodate, even to merge, even to synthesize. We'll see what the answers are. He doesn't succeed entirely, but it opens the door, the vision of all that's going to happen afterwards. Let me announce again. Next Sunday, I'm beginning to share with a eulogy for Rabbi Klausner. The Kollel owes him a debt of gratitude. Not that anyone cares or anyone remembers or anyone knows, but Rakefet, unfortunately, has an event memory, not an image memory. consult my work on the Rav, you'll know what I'm talking about. So I care, and I want to say a few words. Now, something happened last night. I got a call from the Klaus's best friend, Rabbi Machlis, and he's trying to organize something at the OU. So I told him I will speak. It's hard for me to speak at night. I have to jalava the craft, to watch my strength. I had a bad experience in New York. Now I overdid it, and I was I was quite sick for myself, quite sick. So, but in memory of the Klaus, I told my eldest daughter, who I always consult with, and she said, "Kala kavod, Abba, yeah, you're absolutely right." But I still will say the eulogy here. I'll tell you why. The eulogy in Gruss will get much more coverage. It goes around the world. Why you tore that away? I already, from my original words, where I said I dedicated the first year in his memory, people wrote to me from all over the world. They couldn't believe he died, etc. So even if you see it's announced that I'll be speaking at the OU Center, one does not conflict with the other. I want to do it here, and all right, if they work it out, I'll bring cover to his memory. Never, no one to sit shiva, no close relatives. I'll tell you a Rebbe's story happened to me. I don't know. I ought to grow a beard and pay us and put a bekesher on and start receiving kvittles with the pigeon. So a Rebbe's story. I have my websites I go to every day. First the news out of Israel, then I go to the New York Yankees, and then I go to Olamam Shel Charedim to entertain myself. I know Shulzin, you gotta understand, I know him. I know him quite, he was married to my student, I knew his father. Oh, what that guy can come up with is unbelievable. He evidently pays people off to feed him information, to feed him videos. It's amazing sometimes what he comes up with. So I take a look. It says Harav Yosef Klausner died with a nana shaman. He has no one to sit shiva. So I say to Malka, can this be? No, it has to be someone else. He changed his name to Yidra. And then a minute later, I say to Malka, you know, knowing the Klaus, maybe he didn't change his name legally. He just used Yidra. It's not like us. That Rakefet is really my legal name. So we remain at a question mark. Two minutes later, the phone rings, and my Talmud, Dr. Norman Gold, who was handling all my correspondence in America, Normie says, "Rebbe, I just got an email from Sherry. You better sit down." "And what's the email about?" "Klausner died. They're trying to locate relatives. Would I know any relatives?" So first of all, it's a Rebbe's story. Within 2 minutes of raising the question, I get my answer. Two, I immediately knew who to call. And as I said yesterday, those people will be here when I eulogize on Sunday. They came in from America. The Rabbi Lamb was the Klaus's Rebbe in third grade in Ramaz. He retained the relationship with him until today. Chaya Lamb was very close to him too. And she knows whatever relatives he had. I called her immediately. She called Israel to Rabbi Bezhel, to Aaron Bezhel, who was the Klaus's other close friend. And they came up with some distant relatives, but relatives nevertheless. So then we met, and then I'll give the regular class what time allows. We'll go back into, I want to show you something, the Noda Bihud, that I didn't show you yesterday, and then I want to go into announcing pages, which fits right into what we're doing in this class, America 1920s, 1930s, and the type of balabatim you had. And then we'll continue right where we left off, and we'll see further because Rosh Hashanah is approaching, etc., etc. If anyone wants, here are two benches that are absolutely perfect benches. This is, I want a favor from you. A new type of electric shaver came out with Norelco. There's a picture here. It was shown to me. Tell me, have Rabbanim looked at it? It doesn't work. Do you use it? Who is Materit? Here they're matter from Chovevei Torah, but I can't accept that as an authority yet. Do me a favor, bring me the shaver to my office tomorrow and show me how it works. Okay, we'll turn it on and work it. Because it doesn't work like a razor at the end, the sides. Okay, very good. Take this, look at it, read it, and tomorrow bring me. What you'll be doing, I want to tell you something. The Rav was sitting here. It was 57, right, 58, right after class. I said, Rebbe, the Rav just came out with something new. Can I show you the shaver? It went this way instead of Remington Schick this way. The Rav said, show me. Take it apart. I take it apart. I show Rebbe. He looks and he says, I don't understand why it shouldn't be mutter. The whole chetter is based upon the scissor action. And he says, this too is a scissor action. You have the blade and you have the guard. One can't cut without the other. If you use the blade alone, it'll kill your face. The guard does nothing. When you have one on top of the other, it's a scissor, an electrified scissor. Show me this. Oh, I'm so happy. Thank you so much. Gentlemen, I don't know if you're aware of it, but the world is shaking. The Catholic Church is going under. And I have here a whole pile of articles on the Catholic Church, including a woman who gets up in the middle of the sermon and challenges the priest, a woman who had deep belief in Catholicism, and it reaches the New York Times. It is unbelievable. And Baruch Hashem, for once I can say, it's been pretty quiet with our people, with our problems. Stephen Cohn resigns from Hebrew Union College following sexual misconduct. That's the only exception to the rule. And this is, you know, Stephen Cohn is the sociologist, the political scientist, and this is Hebrew Union College, and he resigned. This is from the New York Times. A retirement community turned away married women, lesbians married to each other. Look at the headline, married women. And this retirement community will not take them in. And who knows if they'll sue, what will happen. This is Chabad, Dr. David Laserson, known as Dr. Laz. Read about this with the Rebbe, how he comes. It's amazing, the stories that come out with the Rebbe. All right, I don't, cynics say to me, well, you don't know the stories that there was not success. That doesn't matter. None of us have total success. But the Rebbe had so much success. These stories are fabulous and they're true. This is from Rabbi Bernstein. I saw this already. It's an interview with Ari Berman, with Rabbi Dr. Ari Berman, the president of YU. It's in Hebrew. Why did you leave Israel? What do you attempt to accomplish? A very nice interview with our Talmud, Rabbi Ari Berman. An Israeli sportsman riding horses refuses to compete on Yom Kippur, and it's causing big, big problems. Finally, the Episcopalian, what we spoke about yesterday, that this woman, an assistant bishop, a bishop, got up in public and told stories about Israel, the hatred, that the cultil, we kill Arab kids. And this is a letter my Talmud Norman Gold wrote. It's a very beautiful letter. Finally, for someone who wasn't here yesterday but will hear this share, if you want to have fun and read about Zalman Bernstein and what I quoted yesterday, here's another copy of the book that they published in his memory, the booklet published in his memory by his organization. I want to thank everyone for their participation. I want to thank my wonderful guests who I met in the museum and challenged them to have the guts to come to hear the share in person that they claim they hear all the time on the website. I want to thank them for their participation. I want to wish everyone a great, great week. Besorah Tova, Yeshuot V'Nechamot, Aleinu V'Kol Yisrael, and including meet again in health and happiness. Das V'Danya. To turn it off first, and then unplug it. Jack, any questions?
It's so incassinate. Why isn't it like glycerin where it's so...